Mr. Wagner.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Brett Wagner. I'm an Assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the defendants' appellants in this matter. Your Honors, this Court should vacate the injunction entered by the District Court in this matter and remand the case back to the District Court for the entry of an injunction that is not too broad, that complies with the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and does not unduly limit the discretion of the state prison administrators in their operation of the Illinois prison system. Before turning to the line item specifics of the injunction, I will address two broader principles that underlay consideration of those issues. First, it is well settled that a mandatory injunction should not be overbroad. This rule applies with special force in the state prison context. The Supreme Court, in Bell v. Wolfish and Turner v. Safley, has made clear that prison administrators need deference in the operation of the prison system, that prison management is a task left to the legislative and executive branches of government, and that compels further judicial restraint so as not to involve the courts in the minutiae.
Counsel, those are generalities. Could you be concrete? What do you think this injunction should have said?
This injunction...
Did you propose a draft injunction to the district court that you thought was proper?
We did not propose it. The way that it worked, the court entered the injunction as part of its order. And so at that point, it was what was left for us was to appeal and bring the issues there. Now, certainly throughout the litigation, and there's been extensive litigation on this, throughout the litigation, the defendants made these points that...
Yes, you made these points. These points are perfectly general. They are truisms. But if you're a district court, it really helps to have somebody make a concrete proposal. Apparently, the only party who made a concrete proposal was the plaintiff.
Well, by that time, Your Honor, the court had resolved and found that there had been a due process violation, which was still a matter of contention up until that time. And then in its order, in which it issued its ruling, had granted the injunction. The defendants had not, certainly conceded and were still fighting that there was no due process violation.
But you're anticipating findings of fact and conclusions of law before there was an injunctive order to be entered?
Yes.
And that never happened?
As part of the findings of fact, that's correct.
Was the scope of the remedy a part of the briefing, or was that assumed to be left for later after the district court made a liability ruling?
Well, that was, I believe, assumed to be left for later. Certainly, again, there were discussions as to what due process or arguments over what due process does or does not require all throughout that would impact the determination of what the scope of the remedy should be. But, beyond that, there wasn't necessarily, at least anticipated that there'd be counter-proposals it had been anticipated, or at least it wasn't clear that there wouldn't be a chance to propose to propose something different. The defendants, again, were fighting, saying there's no due process right here, so there's no violation.
My understanding of the chronology and the way this was handled in the district court is that that part of what the prison system was doing in response to this litigation while the litigation was ongoing was revising its procedures for the transfer decisions.
That's correct.
And that it went ahead of a ruling from the court and implemented reforms.
That's correct.
And that was part of the record made at trial. And that the court, in making its decision on liability, went ahead and incorporated those reforms as a part of its injunction.
That's right.
Effectively constitutionalizing them.
That's exactly right. The court constitutionalized the department's reforms and added some things to it. It didn't, and Your Honor is referring to the department's 10-point plan, and specifically point one, that the court in effect constitutionalized by embodying it in an injunction with certain additions. The problem with that approach is simply because the department is undertaking reforms on its own. as endeavoring to come up with a system that works or that it thinks is feasible doesn't mean that that is setting a constitutional floor. Certainly the department could be exceeding constitutional requirements. The department was doing this without any finding that there was a constitutional right even at play here. It wasn't meant to say this is a constitutional floor that should be enforced against us by judicial decree. In effect, the district court, in its very specific injunction order, not only removed from the prison administrators any discretion in finding that their proposed plan didn't work and then changing it or adapting it to the fluid prison situation, but it in effect penalized the department for being proactive, for trying to come up with some progressive options for handling the situation that the TAMS environment or transfer to TAMS, among other things that are embodied in the 10-point plan. The 10-point plan goes far beyond just transfer to TAMS, but all of these things concerning transfer that the department had proposed, and when the department proposed it, they didn't know for certain that things were going to work. You know, it's certainly possible that the department may need to amend or change its procedures now that the district court has constitutionalized it and made those things enforceable by judicial decree. The department doesn't have the ability to continue its experimentation in what works and is required to provide something far beyond the constitutional floor, contrary to what the Prison Litigation Reform Act permits.
The way that I would have anticipated this to be litigated would be that the court would first adjudicate the constitutional claims in the case and enter a ruling on those claims and then proceed to a remedial phase, or perhaps to, at that point, issue an injunction requiring the prison system to implement a plan that meets the constitutional minimums as declared by the Supreme Court, meets or exceeds them.
Right.
Perhaps covering the issues of notice, opportunity to be heard, neutral fact finder, written statement of reasons, and periodic review in general terms.
Yes.
And then invited proceedings on whether the state's reforms that were then in the process of being implemented, in fact, satisfy the requirements of such an injunction and were constitutionally adequate as opposed to constitutionally required.
I think that's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And to be sure, there was an element. The department did, during the course of litigation, the defendants did say, look, we're implementing this plan. And so, you know, this meets the requirements of due process. That was part of the litigation, and that's why the 10-point plan was before the court. And that was part of the arguments. But the court said, well, the 10-point plan is a good start. I'm going to tweak it a little bit and then embody it in an order, as opposed to saying, such as the Supreme Court in Wilkinson did when it looked at Ohio's plan and said, all these things, this is enough. It didn't say any of these things are specifically required, but these things, this is enough. It passes constitutional muster. So I agree, Your Honor. The district court under the Prison Litigation Reform Act should have done was said that the department is required to implement a procedure that complies with the constitutional minimum standard. And then once the department is doing it, you can have litigation over whether that satisfies it or not. But it should not have constitutionalized the steps beyond what otherwise would be the constitutional floor. And there are many steps beyond the constitutional floor that the department had proposed and was implementing through its 10-point plan that is now constitutional and enforceable by judicial decree by the federal contempt power against the state court.
I assume that the parties were never, in fact, invited to submit proposals on what the proposed remedial injunction should say, and this goes back to the Chief Judge's question.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
Was explicitly done. It was sort of folded in.
It was folded
implicitly.
The department. I would say implicitly folded insofar as the defendants were saying there's no due process right, but if there is a due process right, this plan satisfies it as part of that. And the district court, went beyond that, said this plan doesn't satisfy it, and this is the constitutional requirements as opposed to the broader or more discretion-laden injunction that should have been entered under the Prison Litigation Reform Act. And to be sure, Your Honors, there are several places where the injunction does exceed the constitutional floor. Constitutionalizing the requirement of a transfer review committee appointed by the warden of TAMS, as opposed to simply an impartial decision maker. Requiring 48-hour advanced written notice of the reason for why transfer is considered, which was an area where the district court went beyond the department's proposed plan. That was something new the district court added into these proceedings. Again, goes beyond the constitutional floor. Wolf versus McDonald requires 24-hour notice of a disciplinary hearing where an inmate stands to lose good conduct credits. And the court, Wilkinson, found that those type of protections, as provided by Wolf, are not necessary in this type of proceeding concerning a transfer to a supermax prison once you're already within the prison system. Instead, the more informal, less adversarial proceedings, as described in Hewitt versus Helms or Greenholz versus the Nebraska Penal Institution, were adequate. So, not even necessarily the 24-hour, but again, some notice, but constitutionalizing 48-hour written notice goes far beyond the constitutional floor when greater.
It goes 24 hours beyond.
It goes, exactly. It goes 24 hours. It doubled. It doubled the constitutional floor, Your Honor. Additionally, the requirement of a digital audio recording of the entire proceedings, as opposed to some explanation of the reasons for your ultimate decision. Again, this kind of specificity that deprives the flexibility of prison administrators, that involves the court very specifically in the administration of a state prison system, is beyond the scope of Section 3626 of the Prison Litigation Reform Act. Moreover, the requirement of a 10- or 30-day window for hearings whenever possible.
There is something fascinating in the concept of the Constitution of the United States requiring digital audio as opposed to analog or recorder or
exactly. And I don't think the Constitution necessarily mandates a specific medium.
That would be hard to locate in the text of the Constitution.
It would have to be a very living document to get there, Your Honor.
I don't recall anything Thomas Jefferson said about digital audio.
I don't think it was in the Federalist Papers either. So. Finally, the constitutional floor for when hearings should take place is a reasonable time, not 10 days, not 30 days. Layers of review, as provided by the department and constitutionalized by the district court's decision, again, are not required, so long as you have an initial impartial decision maker that adequately ensures that an erroneous decision was not rendered. And finally, the
requirement.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'll wrap up with this. And finally, Your Honors, the decision cited by plaintiff's counsel as supplemental authority, this summer's Supreme Court decision in Brown concerning the California penal system, shows what should be done. That case, the Supreme Court consistently throughout the decision specifically stated that it was up to California. California had the discretion as to how they were going to decrease their overcrowding problem. And it's that type of discretion that has been removed from the Illinois prison administrators by the district court's decision. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Legner. Mr. Mills.
Good morning.
You are being digitally recorded.
Yes, I understand that. And I agree, it is not in the Constitution. Procedurally, I disagree with Mr. Legner. I don't think there was any question in anybody's mind when this trial ended that the judge expected us to present findings of fact, conclusions of law, which included suggestions as to how the remedy should be done. And he made it very clear that this had to be done on a very short schedule because he made it very clear he was going to finish this case before January 1st. He missed that deadline. But nonetheless, when we walked out of that courtroom, that was clearly his intention. There was nobody who was in that courtroom who thought we were going to have a second phase about anything. His very clear statement over and over again was he was done with this case and this was going to be it. In response, the plaintiff, as Your Honor pointed out, in document 526, did give a detailed statement as to what the injunction ought to look like.
I think that's a sound way to proceed. I mean, maybe it's district court made it clear that he was going to proceed that way. Is that the way the federal courts ought to proceed?
I think in an ideal world, the answer may be no, but the issue for this court is whether it was an abuse of discretion to proceed in that manner. Nothing in the statute say you have to proceed in that manner.
That's technically not the issue because the appeal is not premised on procedural errors.
Right.
The appeal is arguing that the district court made a substantive error in the terms of the injunction. But the kind of question I'm asking, and which might concern my colleagues too, is whether making substantive errors like that would be less common if the district judge had broken these issues apart.
Well, I agree, Your Honor. And in fact, in our proposal, we suggested that perhaps the defendant should be invited to make suggestions. The judge did not accept our suggestion. But frankly, it was the defendants who invited him to do exactly what he did. They did have a section of their proposed findings which talked about relief. It's in document 527 at the bottom of page 19. And what they said was, should the court find against us on liability, then you don't have to do anything further than what the regulations say plus what Director Randall has proposed in his endpoint plan. That satisfies due process. It didn't say that's too much. It didn't say that we want an opportunity to present anything else. It specifically said our existing regulations, when you add in the 10-point plan, satisfy.
But look, that doesn't invite the court to put the regulations in an injunction. That sounds like it's inviting the court to say to the defendants, as long as you maintain your current regulations, you're not violating the Constitution. If you do something else, we'll have to think about that. But that doesn't statement, the current regulations satisfy the Constitution, does not imply an invitation to the court to put the regulations in an injunction and make them a federal command.
Well, but it wasn't just the regulations. It was also a 10-point plan, which that's important.
Every
because
time
the regulations,
I hear 10-point plan, it's followed by to end the war in Vietnam.
The
government
reason,
should never announce 10-point plans.
The reason I think it's important to distinguish between those two is because the regulations had the force of law and were, in fact, being followed through. The 10-point plan was not.
But regulations adopted by a state can be changed by the way provided by the state.
Right.
States can't change federal injunctions. Indeed, the whole point of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, I had supposed, was to get district courts out of the business of entering regulatory injunctions like this and require them to do the very least that was necessary. And the very least would be to say something like, there is a liberty or property interest involved here, and you have to provide the prisoners with at least the procedures required by Wolf against McDonald. Yours sincerely, District Court. But the district judge did an awful lot more than that.
He did. On the other hand, I think the problem with an injunction which was worded like that is it would have inevitably led to a second batch of litigation as to whether or not, in fact, they were following it through.
That's what courts are there for.
I'm sorry?
That's what courts are there for.
Well, yes.
See what the injunction is being followed. There's nothing unusual about that.
But the balancing side of an injunction is it has to be specific enough so that it can be enforced.
What was the deadline rush? I missed that.
It was judge-created.
Yeah, but he just decided he was going to do something on a particular day, and that was the end of that?
Well, except that he didn't. He, in fact, took another 7 months beyond his announced deadline.
Deadlines were only for other people. After the
well,
correct.
But and the injunction could easily have set forth in more explicit terms the requirements of the Supreme Court cases for notice, opportunity to be heard, et cetera, and then also announced that the current regulations in place are adequate to satisfy that standard. And it seems to me what the judge did here is make a legal mistake by confusing the concept of what's constitutionally required with the concept of what's constitutionally adequate. And that's obviously an abuse of discretion.
If he had done that, I agree, Your Honor, but I don't think that's what he did. I view what he did differently. He did exactly what the Constitution required, the notice, et cetera.
Where does the Constitution require a transfer review committee appointed by the warden of TAMS?
It doesn't.
It doesn't. Prison Litigation Reform Act says you can't put anything in the injunction that the Constitution doesn't require. You concede the Constitution doesn't require that. We know the injunction is erroneous. It's only a question of how erroneous.
Well, I disagree with you, Your Honor. I think that you're allowed to include an injunction that is enough detail so that it is enforceable and that has specifics in it. I think that the Prison Litigation Reform Act says that he couldn't do something like...
If the injunction was going to be more than the one I said, why didn't the injunction say a neutral decision maker? That's what the Constitution requires. It doesn't require a transfer review committee. It doesn't require the warden of TAMS to appoint the person. Right? It does require a neutral decision maker. That's what you're supposed to put in the injunction. That's what the PLRA says. This injunction doesn't do that. Right? It's transparently erroneous. It's only a question of what we need to do now.
Again, Your Honor, I think that a neutral decision maker is required and that what he did was he adopted the defendant's suggestions as to how that should be implemented in Illinois. If he had just said you need a neutral decision maker, and we had moved later for contempt saying that the person they presented was not neutral, then they would have argued, well, we can't tell exactly what we're supposed to have done from this injunction, and therefore there's no way you can enforce it.
Well, sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. The Supreme Court has said that states, the state judiciary, has to provide neutral decision makers. But you don't see the Supreme Court writing a detailed code of conduct for what that means.
No, not a detailed code of conduct, but they do have something to say about it.
Did anybody bring Baxter against Palmigiano to the district court's attention?
No.
I notice nobody has cited it here. But what the district court did in this case is fundamentally what the Ninth Circuit did in Baxter against Palmigiano. It said, Ninth Circuit said, well, Wolf against McDonald sets minimums. We're entitled to fill in a lot of details. And in fact, one of the details, if I recall correctly, was changing 24 hours to 48 hours. The Supreme Court reversed in a very curt opinion that said, these people need their heads cleaned out. We said what the Constitution requires. This did not invite inferior courts to decide that we needed extra details added. Right? It seems to me this injunction is the clearest violation of Baxter against Palmigiano I've ever seen. But, of course, one of the problems with the procedure was that, given the procedure, nobody called it to his attention.
That's correct. Nobody did. And I frankly am not familiar with the case because nobody has cited it before you. In each case, what he did was take the generalities, as you accurately described them, from Wolf and several other cases, and adopted the defendant's idea as to how that ought to be carried out. Obviously, it's very specific, but I think it's important that the reason it's specific is so that it can be enforced and so the defendants know what they have to do. If they think that something ought to be changed, as the court in Brown said, they have the absolute right and the court has the absolute duty to go in and consider a change.
Have you thought about the ramifications of an affirmance in this case? I mean, if we issue an opinion affirming this highly specific injunction as a matter of constitutional law, that means the Supermax prison in Wisconsin, and if Indiana has a Supermax prison, has to do things this way as a matter of constitutional mandate in this circuit. I mean, that's an extraordinary position.
Well, I don't think so.
It would be fun to have the warden of TAMS appoint the Prisoner Review Committee for Indiana.
I think that an injunction can be tailored to the specifics of the problem that is found. I think that's done every day by...
That's the genesis of the regulatory injunction which the PLRA put a stop to.
Right.
Well, I think it would be a quite different thing if this judge had created out of thin air, and I think that's what the PLRA was adopting to, was judges imposing their ideas on prisons as to what they ought to do. That's not what this judge did. What this judge did was accept the invitation of the defendants as to how this ought to work.
They didn't invite him to constitutionalize the regulatory code for the prison system.
Only
they
in the sense
that... They invited him to accept it as constitutionally adequate, not constitutionally required.
Except that when he asked the question of what should the relief in this case look like, all they did was point him to the regulations and Director Randall's plan. They didn't say, we'd like another hearing. They didn't say, we think you should enter an injunction that says these broad suggestions. They could have made those suggestions. They didn't. Instead, they pointed the judge directly at Director Randall's plan, which was supplemented by detailed questioning by the judge of Director Randall as to why some things were in there and how he thought it worked. And Director Randall was also the director, was the person who was in charge of the plan in Ohio, so he had a lot of personal knowledge as to how the Wilkinson worked out. And there was lengthy examination of him about all of those details, and it was the last day of trial, and it was right from there that we went into the conclusions of fact, et cetera. So, again, I don't think there was any doubt, and I think that the defendants had every opportunity to say, you should have an extremely broad injunction here. Instead, by pointing them to directly at what the judge in fact did, and then to come later in this court and say, well, we should have had a second hearing, when nowhere did they ask for that in the trial court. The judge did exactly what they asked them to do. And now they're here saying the judge abused his discretion by doing so. Could the judge have done something different? Yes, he certainly could have. But I don't think it was an abuse of discretion to follow along with exactly what the defendants invited him to do, which was, when you're looking at the remedy in this case, look at our 10-point plan and look at our regulations, because that's sufficient. Clearly, they were not arguing, by the way, that it was constitutionally sufficient as it was, because all of the 10-point plan had not been introduced. I mean, it had not been actually implemented, nor had it been put into regulations anywhere. This was only a plan, which had not been implemented. So, and it was clearly not sufficient. As Director Randall admitted on the stand, it made no provision at all for advance notice of any kind whatsoever of why you were sent to TAMS prior to the hearing, which Director Randall admitted in his testimony would make it impossible to defend. So even the 10-point plan on its face, had it been put into full implementation before the district court made its decision, would not have met the constitutional minimums. If it had, and if it had had the force of law, then they clearly would have been there then saying this case was moot and we satisfied the Constitution, and they would certainly be here today arguing that. They're not. They're not arguing mootness. They're not arguing that the regulations we have in place, even today, satisfy the minimum constitutional requirements, because they don't. Their regulations, which were changed after this, still don't require a 48-hour or 24-hour or any notice in advance. And that's why they're not here arguing mootness. They're still arguing. They're still, as a matter of law, have it that they don't have to comply with some of the minimum requirements that were set forth in Wolf versus McDonnell many years ago. And that it was in response to that that the district court entered a very detailed order, which they then had a blueprint as to exactly what they were supposed to do, and which was clearly enforceable as a matter of contempt. And nobody could say it was so vague that we couldn't figure out what we were supposed to do. If nobody has any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mills.
Thank you, Judge.
Anything further, Mr. Legner?
One very brief point, Your Honor.
Your Honors, this court did not point to the 10-point plan or what the department's regulations were before the district court to invite the court to constitutionalize it. It pointed to the 10-point plan and administrative relations to say that there is no due process violation going on in Illinois, even if there is a due process right. If this court has no other questions, I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.